From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Kansas, where a construction worker named Nick Smarsh was doing his taxes. Or his guy was doing his taxes. He had heard a lot about taxes in the past year when Congress passed a new tax law. So Nick was looking forward to a bigger return. And the guys on his construction site that week were speculating about just how big their returns would be. And then Nick went to get his taxes done. He's a traveling construction worker, and his mileage is not reimbursed by his employer. His daughter is a journalist, and Sarah Smarsh picks up the story from there. Nick found out that the new tax law does away with the mileage deduction for employees. In the past year, he put 26,000 work miles on his truck, and in the past, he could count on 50 cents per mile. That means that in 2019, Nick Smarsh lost a $13,000 tax deduction. He was stunned. Sarah Smarsh writes that she's heard from many more workers like her father, workers who feel the little dings of tax law changes that aren't so little to them. And we reached out to a journalist who's been working on a book about the American tax code, who's written a lot about taxes at just about every level, who can discuss not only what's in there, but who's affected, and a lot more here this hour with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and founder of DCReport.org. Welcome back. How are you? Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. And yeah, it's a shock when people are expecting a refund and discover their taxes may have actually gone up and they owe money.
I think I saw you on one of the various types kind of talking early on about what this tax law was going to do. I think you were pointing to police officers as an example.
Well, the issue that was raised with your example is the elimination of what are called miscellaneous deductions. So about one in three taxpayers had been, for a number of years, making use of itemized deductions. So they could deduct their property taxes, which are very high here in Western New York, mortgage interest on their home and a second home, and union dues. If you're a police officer, you could deduct the cost of your gun, your Sam Brown belt, your uniform, the dry cleaning of it. Same thing with other first responders like firefighters. And cold turkey, Congress just wiped these out. You no longer get to deduct whatever fee you pay to have your tax return prepared. Or if you buy software, as I do, because I do my wife and I do our own taxes, you no longer get to deduct that. And a lot of people are going to be very shocked. In addition, the old 10% bracket is now the 12% bracket. The 15% bracket is now the 22% bracket. And most of the money, the largest single share of federal individual income tax revenue, comes from the 15% bracket. So I think a lot of people are going to be in for a shock. I just got information from a man in Minnesota whose income went down $3,500 and his federal tax bill went up $2,200. And that's because this tax bill, which was passed without a single public hearing, not one public hearing, voted only by Republicans, the only ones who voted for it, was written by corporate lobbyists for corporate lobbyists, and that's where the big change comes. Corporate America got huge benefits out of this, and many companies, Apple being my poster child for this, are making a huge profit. Apple makes a profit off the corporate income tax under the Trump tax law.
A profit?
A profit of $120 billion.
How do they do that?
Well, since 1987, American multinational companies have been setting up offshore subsidiaries. And they pay money to themselves offshore. So if you buy Nike shoes, every Nike shoe has the Nike swoosh on it, and the company pays to an offshore subsidiary a royalty for the use of that logo. Hilton Hotels does this. Apple does it with their iconic Apple. And essentially, they take money from their American pocket, they put it in their offshore pocket, and they convert a taxable profit into a tax-deductible expense. And so long as the money is in this overseas account, there are no taxes on it. There may be in the jurisdiction they went to, and every deal depends on your particular circumstances as a company, which is why some people go to Grenada, some go to Bermuda, some go to Singapore or Ireland. Apple figured out how to, as they testified under oath, put half their profits nowhere. And, of course, there's no Congress, legislature, or parliament in nowhere, so they paid zip. Now, the money's actually here in the United States. What happens is they buy, say, federal treasury notes or various bank instruments from Chase Bank in New York or Citibank or Wells Fargo. But the address of the account that Nike pays money to for the use of the swoosh on every pair of shoes is somewhere offshore. And American companies had this huge, vast, several trillion dollars of cash offshore, much of which was never taxed. Under this bill, they had to pay the tax. It's a reform I'd called for repeatedly since I first exposed this when I was at the New York Times. Gee, I think it was 2002 that I started writing about this when I figured out what was going on. So Apple announced that they were going to pay $38 billion in taxes, and they said it was the largest tax payment in the history of the world. Here's what they didn't tell you. They owed $88 billion. The Trump tax law gave them a 57% discount. I don't know. I didn't get a 57% discount on my tax bill. Did you get one, Adam?
Evan? Not that I'm aware of.
So they save $50 billion right there. That's profit. It was money they should have had to pay in taxes. They get to keep. They made a $50 billion profit. Then Congress extended them an eight-year loan to pay the taxes. And the interest rate is zero. So I just calculated, based on the repayment schedule, it's in the law, how much they will earn based on their return on their equity. And that's another $70 billion of pre-tax profit. So it's a $120 billion gain for Apple alone. And, you know, with a tax law like that, I mean, of course corporate America loves it. The multinationals make a profit off the tax system. Now, this will change that system, but we've yet to see all of the dynamics of it. And because there were no public hearings, my guess is 10 years from now, if you have me back and I'm still around, that we'll be talking about, well, there were these little things nobody noticed or could figure out the real significance of in the 2017 Trump tax bill that were further benefits no one knew about for various companies in certain situations.
Listeners, if you want to share on our various platforms what your tax bill looks like or if there's any surprises or changes in any direction, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Our guest for the hour is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, founder of DCReport.org, contributor to a number of publications, and the author of numerous books, including a forthcoming book on the tax code. And look, David, you know, maybe Congress will just say, hey, we got rid of some of these deductions because we wanted to simplify. You want to simplify.
Right. Well, this is I wrote a book on the tax code back in 2003, perfectly legal. This is a proposed new tax code for the 21st century.
Simplifying it?
It's very simple. We can shrink the size of the IRS. You don't file a tax return. You can have all the wealth you want. You can give all the money you want to your kids. The key to it is that all taxpayers are treated the same. Right now, we have a bifurcated system where workers and pensioners are treated differently than business owners. And it's much more progressive. Our current system, the highest tax rate in this country now under the new tax law, starts at $500,000 of taxable income if you're single, $600,000 if you're married. Well, in 2005, when I got Donald Trump's tax return, he was making $412,000 a day. Why don't we have a higher rate at a million, 2.5 million, 5 million, 10 million? And so my proposed rates go all the way up to $100 billion of income because we will have a time when there'll be somebody realizing $100 billion income. And you can keep your wealth in an untaxed fund, but when you withdraw it, it's more. So if you're Jeff Bezos, I'm perfectly willing to let Jeff Bezos delay paying taxes on all of his Amazon stock until he goes because it's going to grow faster than the rate of borrowing for the federal government. But when he goes, got to pony up. That's what they do in Canada. That's what they do in a number of countries in Europe. It's called capital gains at death. And wouldn't you rather pay your taxes when you're gone than right now when you got kids to feed?
Well, the interesting thing is polling is a lot more supportive of this than a lot of analysts thought. And that's on a number of levels. First of all, polling is really solidly in favor across the electorate of a 70% tax that, for example, Ocasio-Cortez and other incoming members of Congress have proposed, starting at $10 million of income and up. And that's true, almost true, across political parties. It's something like 45% of Republicans support that as well. But this is there's also a point here when you talk about a death tax or an estate tax, whatever you want to call it, David. Actually, what you call it matters. And this is where Adam McKay and the people who produced the movie Vice did an interesting job. They showed Frank Luntz with a focus group pointing out that when it used to be called the estate tax, people supported it. But they changed it to the death tax. And it was like, oh, government, and you're gone. The government doesn't get my money.
And they got that right out of my book, Perfectly Legal, which won the Investigative Book of the Year Award, where I exactly talked about Luntz.
I thought maybe they called
him. They had him interviewed. They didn't call me, pay me a fee either. But they, but that's exactly where they got this, that marketing, it turns out to be very important to how you describe things.
Yeah, it does. And so I guess you're not surprised to see, though, the polling where it is.
Well, I'm surprised only to the extent that people have to experience things for them to matter. I mean, look, it took 72 years from the Seneca Falls Convention until women got the right to vote. Things don't change quickly overnight. And as people begin to experience things in their own lives, and as they will do this year and next year with the Trump tax law, then they begin to move their opinions. And when people realize, and they've seen enough stories, not just from me, but people who followed after my pioneered this work, on how you can be a multi-billionaire and pay essentially no income taxes, that they began to say, wait a minute, I'm a chump here. I've been had. The argument that, you know, if my boss doesn't get a tax cut, I'll lose my job has gone out the window. And hopefully we'll be more sophisticated about these things in the future. But I would point out David Frum today has a tweet noting that one of the metrics for the internet, that people apparently think the false police report filed by the actor from Empire,
Jesse Smollett, yeah.
Smollett, is that how you pronounce it?
Smollett, yeah.
Smollett, is 55 times more important than the Coast Guard lieutenant who planned to assassinate the Speaker of the House and others.
Yeah.
That's very troubling. It's also partly the blame of broadcast media. One of the networks led with that last night instead of with other more substantive news.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And that is an outsized story. But I think that's a whole separate discussion on how we cover news and how we wait and decide what we're going to prioritize.
There's also a hidden aspect to the Trump tax law. It's very important. Obama came in and we were in terrible financial trouble. And after the first year of his administration, where we had the stimulus program that wasn't nearly big enough, it's simple math that anybody who understands economics knows, to make up for the cutbacks in private spending, we began to see the deficits shrink. And we were on a path they came down by two-thirds. That's now being completely reversed. From the day Donald Trump took office until 2 years to the day later, the federal government's debt grew by $2 trillion or more than 10%. The Trump tax law does not pay for itself. It is a tax on the future. The government can borrow all the money it wants. The government can print money. The U.S. government cannot go broke so long as it can borrow in its own currency. It can make you and I go broke, but it can't go broke. And what we're really doing is borrowing money to give a tax cut to those people whose incomes are north of $600,000 a year. And we have people in this country whose annual income is as high as $4 or $5 billion a year.
But, David, we had Republican member of Congress Tom Reed on this program a year ago when this was being debated. And at least, and I'll say this, and I hope his office is listening, we always appreciate, and Congressman Reed is one of the more accessible members of Congress.
He certainly is.
He has been. He's been for this program and in a lot of different venues. And he said on this program that, number one, he did believe that it could pay for itself. But regardless, he said, look, the average family in Western New York, the average household in his district, which has a lot of poverty, but the average household was going to get a $1,600 improvement on their taxes, a savings of $1,600. And I said, look, if you have 10 people getting a tax cut, and one person gets $91,000 in tax return, and the others get $1,000 apiece, you could say the average is $10,000. But nobody's getting 10,000 except for that one person at the very, very, very top. And they're getting a lot more than that. So you can't just pick an average. And he said, no, he doesn't think it works like that, that most people are going to feel that $1,000, $1,100, $1,200, $1,600. That's what the promise was. Well, what's happening now? Was he wrong?
Well, yes, he's wrong. He is accessible and he's charming, but he's just wrong about this. You know, we had the greatest prosperity in this country under a Republican president, Eisenhower, when the marginal tax rate was 91%. And what we really had was a government policy that said, if you make in today's money about $2.5 or $3 million after tax, you don't need any more money than that. And what we've gone to is a system now where when I was a young man, the wealthiest people I knew in what we now call Silicon Valley, where I was a reporter for the San Jose Mercury, had a small airplane. Today, we have people with their own jumbo jets. And we even have households with Sheldon Adelson being my prime example, his and her 747s, entire 747 to fly one man. And the problem is that at the bottom, we're putting way too much burden on people to support the federal government, and we're not investing in the future. We have this big debate going on about should college be free. Totally wrong debate. The debate should be, in the world that we're in and we're going into, which is vastly more complex and difficult than the one I grew up in, and I'm 70 years old, what level of education is necessary to have a healthy, prosperous society? And it's probably, for many people, includes graduate school beyond college. That should be the debate, though, that we're having. You know, some people in eighth grade education will do them just fine, and some people, a lot of people, we need to get much higher levels of education. Let's have that debate. Let's talk about making the country better in the future. So the tax cuts at the bottom were premised on some things that may or may not prove to be true. But here's a key element in this. Donald Trump originally announced that the married couple would pay no taxes on their first $50,000. Huge coverage for that. When he reduced that to $30,000, I reported on that. This is before we started DC Report. And virtually nobody did. The law that he signed is $24,000. Well, had that law not been signed, a married couple with two kids would have gotten about $23,000, $22,700 to $23,000 of income without it being taxed. So there's just a tiny marginal change here. And now you take away things like mileage for this man who has to drive, union dues, and this was clearly an assault on unions, right of association of working people, police uniforms, tax preparation, all these other things. Take away, for many people, the ability to deduct much of their property tax and their state income tax. And you've really shifted the burden here a great deal. Now, the one upside was they increased the per-child tax credit to $2,000. I was raising my eight children. I wish we had that. But, of course, they're all long gone, and some of my grandchildren are fully grown. But that's probably a very good measure. There's I've written in the past and mentioned on your show something called ALICE. It's a new measure of poverty that appears to be much better than the official government measure. ALICE stands for Asset Limited. You don't have that $400 savings. Income constrained. You don't make very much money. Employed. So you're working, but you're not getting anywhere. And by ALICE, a couple with two kids in Connecticut, New Jersey, New York State needs about $60,000 to really provide fully for their family. That should be sort of, I think, the base that we work from. Income taxes should only apply to what were called, when we got the income tax, surplus incomes. They shouldn't apply, as Adam Smith taught over 200 years ago, to the necessary income to provide you with food, shelter, and clothing. And what's necessary changes. You know, nobody needed a cell phone when they first came out. Today, basically, everybody has to have a cell phone if you want to be employed. You didn't need a refrigerator, and of course, people ate terrible diets a long time ago. So necessaries change over time, but the income tax should apply. Think of it as if you're investing in the stock market, you'll never get rich selling your losers. You get rich by selling your big winners. And those people who are big winners only are big winners because they're in the American society with the legal system, with the education system, with the transportation system, with all the other things, and you happen to be someone who was ambitious and wanted to make money off it. That's great, but we got to harvest your income so that others in the future can do the same thing and America endures.
And that's what we're going to see in the new tax code, the DCJ tax code?
Yeah, one of the points I make in my my new book, which should be out in January, is that just to understand how bad our tax code is, imagine that you have your heart set, you're getting a new car when the new models come out at the end of the summer. So you go down to the dealers and all that's available is the 1915 Ford Model A. Now, it has a four-cylinder engine that might get you up to 40 miles an hour, but you know you don't have to worry about losing your key or your fob because it has a crank engine. It also has a patch kit for your tires because they're going to go flat all the time. But it only costs, in today's money, about $3,000. Would you buy it? I wouldn't buy it. That's our tax system. And we don't need to have a Tesla. We need to have a self-driving car equivalent, and we can because of digital technology. We can track the money. We can stop the cheating. We can encourage investment, encourage entrepreneurs, encourage people to save if we have a 21st century tax system. And by the way, that system would work in every modern country. It won't work in Honduras, but it'll work in New Zealand and Japan and Germany.
It's tax season as we talk about the new tax law. Here's a comment from a listener named Robert who says, I want to push back on the notion that people will start to rethink their political beliefs now that their pocketbook is being hit. My uncle is a police officer, and even though he's paying more than he has ever paid in taxes under the new law, he is still 100% behind this administration and the GOP.
Well, I agree with him. I don't think it'll change your views about the broader political perspective, but I think that a lot of people will reconsider over time, is this tax stuff that I've been fed doing me any good? And here's one thing to think about. When George Bush was promoting the idea that the estate tax took half your money, and I've interviewed people who, they'd heard Rush Limbaugh say, well, as soon as you die, the government takes half of what you have. And, of course, only at the time if you had millions of dollars was that true. And then if you had lawyers, it wasn't true at all. Well, he claimed that the American family farm was being lost to the estate tax. So I went out to Iowa and went to the richest counties in Iowa. And everybody there, everybody interviewed, by the way, were Republicans, and many of them were elected local officials, and some had been national party delegates. They just laughed. It was hilarious. Nobody lost their farm. The White House and the American Farm Bureau sent out a desperate pair of messages. You know, we have to find a family farm, as if one farm would be the basis for policy. Right now, under the Trump tax law, continuing a past practice, when Warren Buffett dies, he can give away all his money and the government will collect zero. We don't allow you to do that on your income during the year. Why would we allow you to do that when you die? No, the government should collect from you. And we should say we want to encourage charity, but there should be limits. And one of the big things that's going to come out a year from now is you're going to see lots of charities reporting that their donations dropped because people can't deduct the donations anymore. Only one in 20 Americans is going to be able to itemize. And there are mostly very wealthy people.
All right. So after our only break of the hour, Diane in Penfield is going to push back a little bit on what she's hearing from David K. Johnston. David always welcomes that. More emails to share with you coming in at connections@wxxi.org. If you want to call the program as we talk about the recent tax cuts, how it's impacting you in any direction, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Our guest is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and founder of DCReport.org. Back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about how language evolves over time. Take the word woke. What does it mean? And is it used more ironically or as a way to sort of taunt these days as opposed to an honest term about recognizing oppression? That's just one example. We'll take a look at how phrases, words change with their meaning over time and whether we can recognize it in real time. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get some more of your feedback here. And I'm going to start with Diane in Penfield in this half hour with David K. Johnston. Diane writes to us and says, Two-thirds of Americans take the standard deduction, which has been doubled this year. So whoever David K. Johnston is referring to about losing all their deductions is misrepresented, since two-thirds of the people are not deducting mileage, their uniforms, or anything else that he enumerated. It's unfortunate, she says, that the only people you seem to invite are people who misrepresent everything they hear and see.
Well, Diane, you're both 100% right and 100% wrong. And this is why journalism matters instead of PR work by politicians. Yes, the standard deduction was doubled, and it's now $24,000. But taken away was the personal exemption that you would get. So if you're a family of four, you would have gotten about $23,000 of income without being taxed in 2018 under the old law. Under the new law, you get $24,000. So you got about $1,000 more income. And by the way, your tax on that first $1,000 or $1,300 is 12% now instead of 10%. So your tax rate went up. Now, if you're a married couple with no children and your income is modest, you're better off under this bill. These are very complicated issues, and everybody's situation is different.
Yeah.
And that's because we have used our tax code to achieve all sorts of social purposes instead of focusing on raising revenue for the government today and building an economy that will raise sufficient money in the future. So, a lot's been made out of we doubled the standard deduction to not discuss that in the context of we took away the personal exemption is important. Now, what about the third of people who itemize? They tend to be better off. You can make a case that we shouldn't have this kind of itemizing, and I've certainly made that case that there are better ways to do this. But people weren't given, there was no public debate. Police officers' unions, for example, did not get the opportunity to say, wait a minute, what do you mean we can't deduct our union dues anymore, which was a blatant, deliberate effort to weaken unions in this country. If there's anything that the Republican Party has stood for a long time, it is, you know, getting rid of unions or making them totally ineffective. And by the way, if you track the data on incomes in America, you will notice that as the share of workers who belong to unions has declined, there's been an almost perfectly parallel match in what's happened to the incomes of the bottom 90% of workers. So, what about those folks that were deducting? Well, one in three Americans was itemizing. I've been one of those my whole life.
Yep.
Now it's going to be one in 20. If you bought a house and expected when you sat down and said, well, can we afford to buy this house? Here's how much my property tax is going to be. Here's how much the interest on the mortgage is going to be. Here's how much the tax savings will be. You're going to be in for a real shock. And that's not a way to do tax law. We shouldn't be doing tax law in secret without public hearings. And furthermore, why would we want to have a tax law that hits and hurts moderately successful working people? In my example here, let's say a cop married to a nurse who are both in unions and can deduct some of their work-related expenses, or a cop married to a teacher. Teachers were also hit hard by this change. And give huge tax cuts to people whose income is in the millions of dollars a year.
Because they're supposed to be the job creators.
Well, you know what? They're going to create just as many jobs. I mean, you know, Jack Welch left General Electric in a mess and walked away with almost $1 billion, which he had to give up because of an article I wrote about $70 million worth of his perks when people understood what they were really about. And he would have worked just as hard for $50 million. I want to reward people, and we have a marketplace and a competitive market, but this was really a tax bill that was designed to do two things. It was designed to reward large donors to the political system, and only Republicans voted for this bill, which tells you it wasn't bipartisan. This was partisan tax law, and it was heavily focused on corporations. They got a 40% cut in their tax rate. A 40%. You get a 40% cut? No. No,
and you're talking 35 to 21.
35% of corporate profits, nominally at least, under the law, to a 21% rate.
Right. It's a 40% cut.
And lots of all these rules that I've exposed for years that redistribute money upward, that no one's ever disputed, and no serious person in the world of tax and corporate finance and government finance has disputed anything that's in my three books, because they're all from the public record. The whole system of upward redistribution to the very wealthiest Americans is unchanged under this tax law.
Let me go ahead and read. A different Robert writes to us and says, my overall tax rate, which is taxes due divided by my adjusted gross income, went down 2%. I am not getting a refund this year, and I will have to pay over $2,500 to the IRS since I was taxed at a lower rate throughout the year.
Right. So many people are going to get a modest cut in their total tax bill, but the Treasury Department issued regulations to reduce your withholding. And that was to give people an immediate sense of you get some benefit out of this. I mean, politically, it was a very, very smart move, Evan. But it's left many people, they're going to be owing the government. Here's the upside to that. If you underpaid your taxes this year, apart for very extreme examples, you will not pay penalties. You might get hit with interest bills, but you won't pay penalties. So, you know, do your taxes as soon as possible to minimize any interest you owe, but you won't pay a penalty.
Okay. Josh Reston says, previous years I owed roughly $500. This year I owe $4,000. And here's another comment for saying, I'm a small business owner, lost much of what could be itemized in favor of the standard deduction, likely shuttering my passion in the coming months as this is untenable.
Well, now we get to this job creator issue, okay? Small business people like me, we're hit very hard by changes in this law, and it has all sorts of odd consequences in it. For example, on my book royalties, I only have to report 80% of the income if my income doesn't exceed a certain level. But if I were an accountant or an architect or a lawyer, I don't get that. And yet we're all doing, you know, creative writing work in essence. And so this law is full of all sorts of anomalies. There's a saying we've lost sight of in this country about taxes, which I'll update to the modern era. Used to be said that, you know, we should tax chocolate chips and potato chips the same way, and I would add microchips. Profits are profits are profits, and if we're going to tax corporate profits, and my system gets rid of the corporate income tax and replaces it with something else that you'll see in the book, that is much more encouraging of investment and growing the economy. We shouldn't say, well, we're going to pick winners by favoring the potato chip industry over the microchip industry, over the buffalo chip industry. Way too much social engineering in our tax code.
Listeners, if you want to continue with your stories on what you're experiencing in your taxes this year with David K. Johnston, investigative reporter, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and the founder of DCReport.org, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. I want to ask you about this notion that with the current state of where things are, you could see a lot of wealthy people moving out of New York State as an example.
I'm sorry. That is just hilarious. First of all, there's absolutely zero evidence of this.
Tom Golisano did it.
Yeah, but he did it before this tax law. There are people who move out of one state to another, and notice he did it when he was no longer running the company. And if you are a low-income American, if your income is under about $30,000 a year, New York is actually one of the most tax-friendly states to be in because you get high services and you get $20,000 of pension or IRA money tax-free per person, and your Social Security isn't taxed. But people move all the time. I mean, I left California. I didn't leave it for tax reasons. Almost nobody.
You're saying no wealthy, like ultra wealthy people have left New York State?
I'm sure that you can find an example somewhere and somebody will tell you that's the reason, but there are often other reasons that have to do with, you know, I'm tired of the snow in the winter, or I got a great deal on a place in Florida or Arizona. The county I showed years ago when I came here 25 years ago that we had the largest connection to, in terms of people moving back and forth, if you went outside a ring of about 500 miles, was Los Angeles County, where I used to live. Monroe County and Los Angeles County. Why? Well, let me see. Kodak, Bosch and Lomb, other companies that had business interests out there, and people moved back and forth. By the way, nothing is done in this law about something called DINGs. Those are Delaware non-grantor trusts. If you're a very wealthy Wall Streeter, you put your money into a ding or similar vehicle, and then you don't pay New York State taxes. And as Harvey Wasserstein, who was the head of Wasserstein Perella, said to me one time, shouting at me on the telephone, you know, he says, you think I'm an idiot? Of course, I'm not paying, you know, taxes on this stuff in New York. That's why I set up my Delaware Trust. So
what should be done?
Well, we need to have a system in which we treat all people the same. You shouldn't be able to hire lawyers. This constant thing I hear about, if we raise the tax rate to 70% over $10 million, people will hire lawyers to get out of it. Not if Congress sets up the rules so that the lawyers don't matter. And I, you know, I teach pre-law at Syracuse. I want to eliminate the jobs of about 75% to 90% of the tax lawyers and the tax accountants in this country. You know, I want us to use all that incredible intellectual
firepower. You're a job destroyer.
Well, I put them into areas that are productive. Let's build things. Let's not avoid taxes.
Maxine on the phone in Rochester with David K. Johnson. Go ahead, Maxine.
I get, and I really agree with your point about taxing chocolate chips the same as potato chips. But what about when you have something that you really want to encourage, like green energy? Is there any room in your plan for basically treating things the same, but also making some encouragement for things, or research and development, something like that, things that we really do want to encourage?
Thank you, Maxine. Yes, but remember that the way right now we subsidize fossil fuels. In Louisiana, where 60% of the hydrocarbons in this country that move through a pipeline pass at some point through Louisiana, they literally tax the people of that poor state to subsidize the pipeline companies. The answer to that is right now we give huge benefits to fossil fuels, and we're not taking into account their total costs. The point when people say there is no free lunch. So burning fossil fuels leads to all sorts of problems, from asthma to global warming, climate disruption. And we need to have a tax code that's neutral about that. If Congress wants to encourage, as I hope they do, smarter ways to gather energy, particularly electricity, which is increasingly important, then the way to do that is not through the tax system. It's through providing direct subsidies for those things, because we've agreed we need to have them, and often to have a transition to move in the direction of doing that.
So what's the difference between a direct subsidy and a tax? Because basically it all comes out of our tax. I mean, it's not called a tax, but it is a tax because we're paying for it.
Right. The reason, when you put it in the tax code, that's a really good question, Maxine, you obscure it and you hide it. It's not obvious. One of the things I will do in my system is replace the child tax credit, and we have five different child tax credits of various kinds and five definitions of children in the tax code. I just take all that out of there and turn it into we decide here's how much we think parents need as a public subsidy for their children, and we pay you. That's what they do in other countries like Europe. Don't muck up the tax code with all this other stuff. Use the tax code to raise the revenue you need, and in some cases you want progressive taxes. For other things, you don't. Sometimes a tax that's flat is perfectly fair and reasonable. Healthcare is one of those areas. And then for other things, make an appropriation so it's obvious what we're doing and people can look at it.
Maxine, thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Rochester and Dorothy next on the phone. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment about charitable deductions. I don't support the new tax law. I did not support President Trump, but I do not think that people should be given an incentive to give to charity. I think charity is just something that you do, and I continued to give to charity this year. However, I didn't see a good return on my taxes with the way they changed the withholdings. And we don't make a lot of money. I'm a teacher. My husband works in stock, not stock market, like stocking shelves.
Right.
So, yeah, we didn't do too well.
Dorothy, I think it's a reasonable, perfectly valid question. Should we continue the charitable deduction? The theory of this, it's always been in our income tax code, is that you have relinquished 100% of that money. You give $100 to Charity X, your income has now been reduced by $100. Do we want to support and encourage this? But what we haven't thought about very much is, well, what's the difference between that kind of a gift and someone who sets up a charitable foundation for their family, which, among other things, provides jobs for, you know, sons-in-law who aren't very good workers or grandchildren or whatever. And what kind of limits do we want to have on this activity if we're going to have a tax deduction? I think at an absolute minimum, we need to limit it to 20 or 25% of your income. I mean, overall giving in America is about 2% of people's income, which is interesting what the imams teach you're supposed to do if you're a Muslim, 2 to 2.5%. And it's been consistent for a long time at about that level. But I think it's an absolutely valid debate to have, should we have a charitable deduction? But the reality is, lots of charities are going to discover that if you have a $24,000 standard deduction for a married couple, they only get $10,000 of state and local taxes or SALT. If the only other thing you have is, because you paid off your mortgage, for example, the only other thing that you have is charitable gift, the first $14,000 you give, there's no deduction for it. Now, my wife and I addressed this because in December of 2017, before the law took effect, we went and borrowed against the income we knew was coming in the spring and donated, I don't know, 10 or 12% of our income to finance our charitable giving for the next 5 years through a charitable checking account at the Community Foundation. But very few people did things like that. But it's an example of where the tax code allows you to do things that sort of weren't intended. And you're going to see a lot of charities that depend on small donations and moderate-sized donations are going to be in trouble. But you're probably going to hear about this roughly a year from now.
Robert in Fairport next with David K. Johnston. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, what's your guess there saying doesn't necessarily agree with some of the recent reports on this that have been published in the Wall Street Journal. In April, they published a report that said that the top 20% of taxpayers' income over 150 grand or more, the top 20% are going to pay 87% of income taxes, and that's up from 84% last year. You're also seeing recent articles on interest in high-end real estate picking up in Florida from people in New York State. A gentleman quoted in an article in the last couple of months says 90% of all the deals over $10 million were, quote, tax refugees. Finally, I kind of would like to hear a little bit more about the credentials for your guest. Is this guest a CPA, certified public accountant? Does he have a degree in finance, any kind of degree at all? I'm kind of curious.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you.
Robert, I have been writing about taxes, which made my career when I was a teenager. At 19 years old, I was a front-page staff writer at the San Jose Mercury. I teach at Syracuse University in the law school. I've been there for 10 years. I used to teach third-year law students and graduate business students, and then I teach pre-law students. And I've lectured at universities on every continent in the world except Antarctica, which doesn't have any. I do not have a college degree. I have 8 years of full-time college, including doctoral-level studies at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Economics, because I skipped freshman and sophomore general ed courses in favor of upper division and graduate school courses. And as I was told at the time, well, you got an extraordinary education, but we don't give degrees for that. And I won a Pulitzer Prize and been a finalist three times, a finalist, not anybody can be nominated, a finalist for my exposés of the tax code. Two presidents have changed their tax policies because of my work. Congress and various legislatures have passed many laws. Now, on the point you made, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, unfortunately, doesn't have the integrity of the Wall Street Journal news pages. And I happen to bring with me today a piece dissecting the very misleading ways that the Wall Street Journal uses numbers. The journal tried to sell people, and I thought that's where you were going to go when you mentioned the time of the article you had seen, that the Trump tax law led to an increase in revenue. It did not. Corporate revenue fell 28%. Individual income taxes nominally rose 7.9%, but when you adjust for the size of the economy and the inflation, they fell. And we are borrowing money. I mean, there's no dispute that this tax law will cause us to borrow an additional $1.5 trillion. That's a 10% increase in the debt that was publicly traded at the time it was passed. Oh, and by the way, Robert, I have a wall full of plaques from graduate accounting schools for my work about accounting.
When it comes to the annual deficit in this country now, the annual deficit, which you always hear about during campaigns,
right.
You do not hear about very often.
Well, I hope we hear a lot more about
during the actual governing.
Basically, we have $1 trillion-plus annual deficits as
dollars.
Far as the eye can see.
Yeah.
And there's been very good work done going back and showing that had we not passed the 2001 Bush tax cut law, today we would have retired nearly all the federal debt. Now, when you retire federal debt, you slow down the economy. It's one of those odd things. It's just like when we run a bigger trade deficit, our economy is stronger, not the kind of thing you would normally expect intuitively to be the case. And remember, Ronald Reagan ran for office when our debt was about $1.2 trillion, promising he'd retire it. Donald Trump said, if you elect me in 8 years, I will retire the federal debt in 8 years. And instead, he's been adding to it every year because Donald, whom I've covered for more than 30 years, longer than any other journalist and written two international best-selling books about, doesn't know anything. He really doesn't have an idea when he talks about these matters.
Let me get another email in from, this is from Christina, who writes, thanks for the discussion today. People do not understand what the new tax law does. You get more money back on your paycheck, but it is a huge hit at the end of the year. I get minimal reimbursement for job expenses, and now I can't claim it, even if I could still itemize. I can no longer claim all the state and local income taxes for New York as well. SALT is a big issue. Tell me a little bit more about that, David.
Well, you know, here we live in Western New York in just about the highest property tax jurisdiction in the country. I think Brighton, where I live 1 year, was literally the highest property tax jurisdiction in the country. And so it's very common for people in New York to pay. I own a $300,000 house. I think I paid $13,500 in property taxes in the last 12 months. That's 4%, more than 4%. We pay state income taxes. And now that you can only deduct a portion of that, it's going to have a serious effect. In Westchester County, apparently, the average deduction is going to drop for state and local taxes from something like $90,000 down to $10,000. I'm doing that from memory, so I may be wrong, but it's a huge, significant drop. And the reality is that the high-tax states, which tend to be blue states, are also the states that have the higher-paying jobs because taxes finance, or should finance, the commonwealth goods and services that are needed to encourage private wealth creation and increase, which is what we want to be doing. We want to be encouraging domestic capital investment. Here's one thing the Trump tax law did that's very important. I mentioned Apple got a $50 billion write-down, a 57% discount. That's because it held all of its money in cash and cash equivalents. Had they invested it in factories overseas, they would have gotten a 70% discount. So Donald Trump, who said, I'm going to bring jobs home, actually signed a law that said to companies, we will give you a bigger tax cut if you built your factory overseas instead of in America.
Let me close, and I'm on the fence about whether I want to pose this question from a listener, but because I think it's a little incendiary in tone. But Mike says, does your guest think that the current elite and the huge inequity in the tax system has any parallels to 18th century France?
Well,
is that too incendiary?
No, I don't think that's too incendiary. I mean, if you were born...
I don't want people to get nervous here.
Well, if you were born in the 1700s in France, your entire economic life was determined by your gender and your order of birth. If you were a second son, tough luck. If you were born into a poor family, that's where you're going to be. And that's because through trusts, which have been heavily growing in this country in recent years, including dynasty trusts that last forever instead of 100 years plus 21, or I mean the last living person plus 21 years, which is about 121 years, all the land, all the important assets were tied up in trusts. They were owned by the state or by the church or by the nobles. And we want to have a dynamic economy. You know, Warren Buffett's right. I made all this money, but it's not my future progeny's money. It's my money. And they need to go out and earn their own. Now, he left plenty of money to his kids. They're billionaires. But the point is you need to have a dynamic economy. Our tax system shouldn't be about you and me. It should be about making the greatest country in the history of the world, the place that has done more than any other political system to liberate the human spirit, to see what humans can become, to make it endure.
Okay, so it wasn't too incendiary a question. Finally, for you, David, in our last minute here, and again, it's dcreport.org if you want more on David's work.
It's free, and there's no ads.
Free and no ads?
Yeah, free. It's entirely supported by donations. Most of them are $3 and $5 and $10 a month. I don't get any money out of it. I put money into it. It's run by former senior editors at the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, the New York Times. Most of our writers don't get paid. A couple of single mothers we give $100 fees to. And we have broken many, many major stories that today we have a story nobody else has reported, that on the southern border, where there's supposed to be an emergency, there's been a 16 to 34% drop, depending on where you are, in federal prosecutions for immigration crimes and drug crimes. And you'll be shocked to see how few there are. And just go to dcreport.org.
And again, if you had a chance to sit down with members of Congress, as sometimes you do, talking about these issues, the next time Tom Reed comes on this program, we're going to talk about this tax bill a year later here. What do you think we should ask him?
Well, I think you should ask him about why do we have all this social engineering in the tax code, and why do we require people to file a tax return at all when the government has the data, and for people in private business like me, we could have the data.
We don't need to be filing tax returns in this way.
Absolutely.
But it is so much
fun.
California
has proved that. California has a system called ReadyFile.
But it's so much fun, Dave.
Oh, yeah. It's just the biggest joy of my life to spend a couple of weekends doing tax returns.
Everybody does. It's a great pleasure. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. Thanks for being here, as always, David.
Thank you.
Short break. More Connections coming up.